you can build a deep sense of culture without having to be around the same set of people all day, every day, 5 days a week.
You've scanned the headlines, read the articles, and liked the posts. Now listen to the experts themselves in the Future of Work podcast, presented by Allwork.space. Are you ready?
Today, our guest on the Future Work podcast is Jamie Hodari, the CEO and co-founder of Industrious, the highest rated workplace as a service company in North America. Under his leadership, Industrious has grown to over 145 locations across more than 50 cities since its founding in 2013, and is recognized by commercial real estate leaders for its asset-light model based on landlord partnerships rather than traditional leases. Most recently, Industrious's name is one of America's 500 fastest growing companies by Inc. magazine and appeared on Forbes' annual list of the best startup employers. Jamie holds a JD from Yale Law School, an MPP from Harvard University, and a BA from Columbia. Welcome, Jamie. Glad to have you on the Future Work podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited.
Well, we're very excited to have you too. And of all those things you've accomplished, candidly, being one of the best employers has got to be one of the most meaningful to you.
I certainly feel that way. I think that's true. Anyone who starts a business, you know, you realize very quickly the constituent group that in certain ways moves you the most is being there for your team. But especially if you're in a service business, you have to have happy employees
absolutely.
Who want to be there, or you really can't even deliver a product that customers would be excited about.
No, I think that's absolutely right. No question about it. So kudos to you for having accomplished that. We're here to talk about the future of work. And the future of work, really, in many respects, has been referred to, as we change the way we work, as a 15-minute city. Short commutes, amenity-rich, walkable environments, generally lower commercial office vacancy rates, and higher flexible workspace member utilization. How does that 15-minute city play in with the way you created Industrious, and how do you see it working for all of us in the future?
It's a great question, and I think 15-minute cities, that's a phrase that you hear a lot right now in a lot of different contexts, but certainly what I would say is, you know, we have always endeavored to create workplaces that people want to be at, where people want to be, and some of that has changed as a result of the pandemic. What we see most notably is that people have, in many ways, become much more sensitive to commutes, and they want to work. They want to go into work for 2 hours a day, come out and go to yoga class, go back in. So they want to stitch their work together with other parts of their life. And when you combine those two things, what we find is the industrious locations that are in neighborhoods, very animated places where people work and they can go out to eat and they can go to the yoga classes I described, those are doing extraordinarily well. The ones that are in very vibrant downtowns that match that are doing very well. And the industriouses that are in very office first or office only downtowns that feel very empty after 6 p.m., we've seen less demand for those these days than we did pre-pandemic. And we couldn't have anticipated all those changes, obviously, when we started the business. But certainly as a result of that, I would say we were beefing up our locations in neighborhoods that surround city centers, in mixed use areas, and are still going to add new locations in central business districts, but probably at a much slower rate.
Well, you know, I think that's got to be true. There's two things that seem to be happening. First, your comment about the commute. Absolutely. People hate it. It's costly. It's time consuming. It takes them away from the things they want to do. It makes them less productive in their job. And we've seen cities that are dependent on literally importing their workers on a commuting basis, particularly with public transportation, as the cities that were the most hit and have had the hardest time in recovery overall. And I would challenge that we're going to have to see a repurposing, with vacancy factors being what they are in many respects, from people that can't import their workers or choose not to anymore. We're going to have to see a repurposing of cities, and your 15-minute city concept, which is a common concept, it's not just yours, but that concept is going to be a part of that repurposing so that people don't have to the basically the people, and let's use New York as an example, the people that work in New York will also live in New York, which if buildings are repurposed, commercial buildings are repurposed even in part, will allow for potentially lower cost residential costs and allow for that to happen. I'm curious whether you think that's something on the horizon or whether you think, nah, never going to happen.
That's the dream. I mean, obviously, a lot of the country is working through right now what the economics are of that. The New York Times just had a great article showing how certain types of office buildings are very well suited for residential conversions and other ones are very poorly suited. And so there's, you know, there's some very physical realities to that. But yes, the dream is to have cities, to have submarkets and neighborhoods that are mixed use rather than residential only areas, dining out and partying only areas, office only areas. That model, the Robert Moses model or however you would define it, I think has long been strained and has had issues that made it a little bit unsustainable. And I think post-pandemic has been revealed to be something that people really don't like. And so to that point, you need to add residential to areas that are primarily office. And you need to add office to areas that are primarily residential. I mean, we have industrious locations that we've shoehorned into places like Crown Heights in Brooklyn or, you know, various areas around the country that are primarily residential, and they do extraordinarily well. And they're clearly under office. There's a lot of demand for places where people can walk or bike to work. And so to me, that's in certain ways, it's symmetrical. You have to take these places that live for one purpose and one purpose only and find ways to make them true 15-minute multi-use cities where you can get everything you want in your life within a space that's either walkable, bikeable, or is a 10-minute drive, not a 45-minute drive each way.
Well, I think you're right. And I think you can liken cities to people in many respects. We all want to have a multi capabilities and personalities and things of that nature. And if you had a person with a single trait in their personality, they'd be pretty boring.
Yes.
So when we have these areas that are single use areas, they do get boring and at different times during the day overall. And I don't think that works. And it's funny because office only, residential only, that's really a pretty recent phenomena. I mean, go back to even the mid last century, there was a lot of over under, you know, a shop below, residence above, something below, office above. There was an awful lot of that everywhere. And you go back another 50 years, and that's the only thing that existed just about.
And it's very American.
It is very American. I see the city with personalities. We can go to Europe and walk down the street and see that today.
Yes.
Everywhere. And not only is it very American, I think it's very post-World War II.
Yes.
Yeah. So this is a phenomenon that is correctable if we recognize it and deal with it overall, I believe. But you said something that was really interesting. You said that it's more bikeable. Okay, and I want to bring something up in that regard. We've been advising people when they develop properties and projects in the flexible workspace industry in particular, since probably about 2017 or so, it's much better to choose a location for development on a bike path than on a metro path. And as we see, I won't call it a flight to the suburbs because an awful lot of the workers already live in the suburbs and we're going to the cities. As we see people say, no, I don't want to do that anymore. The city isn't ready for me yet. Or whatever the thing is. They don't mind being in the office. They just don't like the commute. How do you think the sustainability of suburban workplaces will be in the future by comparison to the central cities? Will people stay in the suburbs until the cities are reimagined? Or will they, what do you think is going to happen?
This is where we're getting into sort of urban planning and things where I don't want to represent any false expertise or, you know, even the phraseology of it sometimes is, you know, the experts really have the exact distinction.
Hey, go out on a limb.
Yeah, and it's just, I'll go out on a limb, but I'll just say the difference between a streetcar suburb and an exurb, and, you know, sometimes that can be a little bit opaque. What I observe is there's a lot of demand for example, I grew up in Michigan in a true residential-only bedroom community called Bloomfield Hills, and there was no downtown, but there was a town adjacent to us called Birmingham that had a very cute little downtown, and it was walkable, and it was still a suburb, but it had some of that mixed-use flavor. And right now, I do think you see very rising demand for working in those types of settings. So when you talk about suburbs, I think oftentimes people picture office parks, and we do need to figure out what to do with office parks. But if I had to make a bet, for example, you know, I would want an Industrious on Main Street in Greenwich, Connecticut, even if someone lived 15 or 10 minutes away and would drive, but then they're working in a mini downtown where they can walk around. That's the suburban pattern, I think, is very durable. These miniature, very cute downtowns that are walkable, that have city-like qualities, I think those are going to do very well for a very long time. That's not a temporary trend while people wait for, you know, to redevelop an appetite to commute an hour each way. But the deep suburbs, where if you were going to leave your home, you're talking about working not in a cute downtown, but in a in an office park, that seems more permanently impaired to me.
Yeah, I would agree with that, by the way. And as we see in Europe, where those villages, so to
Yes.
speak, with those great high streets, not main streets, with those great high streets, surround a lot of the major metros. We have seen a flight to those areas by the workers and the creation of workplaces that allow them to still be connected. And usually they're connected around a bike path, but also a metro path.
Yes.
Usually there's connectivity to both. And 'cause I think when it comes to commute, people don't like the habit of commuting, but most people don't mind commuting for a purpose. So to go into that important meeting or to go meet that important client or to get something you can only get in the central city, people usually don't mind that at all. So you've used the word hybrid. We are going to a work from home, work near home, work in the city, work at the clients to work anywhere environments overall, I believe. And one of the things, though, that's always challenged in that by seems to be challenged in that by the CEOs of major corporations is, oh, I've got to keep my company culture together. Therefore, we all have to sit in the same building at the same time and sing Kumbaya in a chorus. That seems to be breaking down a little bit. But culture, not just where you work or the facility type that you work in, but mostly who you work with is very important. So a sense of community that is cross-generational, that allows people from different backgrounds and different professions to intermingle and maybe grow. How does that play with what you're doing at Industrious or how you see the whole flexible workspace and co-working community overall?
I couldn't agree more about the importance of the people who you're around. I guess I would start by saying I very much agree that we are moving towards a employee choice, work from anywhere world. If not, we're already there to some degree. And I think it's okay to see your colleagues less frequently than people did in the past. What I see from a lot of our customers, it is hard if you never see your colleagues, if your entire world is virtual. But to me, there's a little bit of a shift almost from the high school model to the university model, where in high school, the way you build a high school culture and a sense of affiliation with high school is everyone goes to the same four classrooms every day, 5 days a week. And then people go to university, and you might go to a 40,000 person university. Sometimes you go to class. Sometimes you skip, sometimes you go study in the library, sometimes you only really see the other people in your dorm, and you'll go weeks and weeks maybe without seeing people outside of your small close group of friends. but it is episodic or periodic. You once in a while see all the other students at the football game. You know, you sometimes go to events in the Student Activity Center, and that method that's more dispersed, and then once in a while you gather and you maybe only see a subset of people, you know, a lot of people feel more affiliation for their university than they necessarily did for their high school. So you can build a lot of institutional affiliation. You can build a deep sense of culture without having to be around the same set of people all day, every day, 5 days a week. I mean, my best friend, who I love, I probably see once every 3 weeks. And that's enough to keep a very serious, very close relationship going. And so in a lot of ways, I think the workplace is like that. To your point about people don't mind commuting once in a while for a purpose, I think our happiest customers tend to work from home a day a week, maybe 2 days a week, go to a local no commute office many days, and then maybe once a week will commute all the way into downtown to see a lot of their colleagues. And I don't see those people losing a sense of connection. And one of the most wonderful things, I guess, to finish would be that they get the community of their workplace on the days they go into downtown. And then they get their local community if they go into a local space in Wimbledon in England, or, you know, in Brooklyn or in Short Hills in New Jersey, some of whom are their colleagues and some of whom might just be people who work at other companies, but who live in their community, and they get to meet and go out to lunch and develop those relationships. That's an amazing combination of factors that can, you know, enrich someone's work life, but also their social life.
Well, I would agree that you can actually get burdened by only seeing the same people every day and only seeing them in a work environment. You know, think of the sitcom The Office. My gosh, what a chaotic, horrible place to live and work. But that happens. There's a reason it's a sitcom, is because it's real. Yeah. Overall, and as human beings, I think we like variety. And we like new things. It keeps us stimulated. And really nothing's more stimulating than sitting next to somebody that you don't know, but who is equally capable as a professional that you can share new thoughts with. So how important and how do you create and engender a sense of community within your own facilities?
This has been a journey for us over the last decade. How do you create and engender a sense of community in the spaces? And it's changed over time. And I don't think we've perfected it, but what I see is about 30% of people in most of our spaces, or about a third, they're active about wanting to meet new people and interact and go to events. And so those people would say, if you said, is it important to you to be part of a community, they would say yes, and they would opt in, and they would choose to participate in all sorts of events that, to your point, engender that or help create that. And then about two-thirds of people would say, I'm a little bit of an introvert, or I already have enough friends. And they feel, in certain ways, suspicious of anything that feels too overtly about creating community. But there's a lot of research that a lot of what makes you feel connected to others, a lot of makes you, you know, that combats isolation, it can be thinner than people expect. Like a smile when you walk in, someone saying, hey, I know you're an almond milk person. You know, we're out right now, but someone's running the store. We're going to have it in 20 minutes if you sit tight. So you feel seen, you feel noticed. Moments like that. Or, you know, again, once every few weeks, a collision with someone else at the space. Those often can be very meaningful to people, even if they're in the subset of people who think that community is not as important. So what we try to do is actively provide the more affirmative, proactive opportunities for connections with others for the one third of people who really want that. And for the two thirds that, again, feel a little bit differently about that, we try to be very subtle. We try to not be coercive. We try to create opportunities to connect with others, or even just to smile at someone or feel seen. And then people can opt in if they want to be part of the more sort of active moments of community. And oftentimes over time, you get the same amount of customer loyalty and sense of connection for both of those populations.
So do you think that community actually extends the life cycle of the customer within a center, a flexible workplace center, overall?
Yes, absolutely. I would say even to step away from flexible work centers, you know, when you look at the Gallup Q12 survey, which is kind of the oldest gold standard survey for employee engagement, you know, of the 12 questions, the one that's most highly correlated with workplace engagement, how long someone stays at a job, is do you have a best friend at work? And so it's quite clear for any employer, having a sense of community or connection with people around you that goes beyond just, hey, that's Becky from accounting, is an extraordinarily important part of enjoying your work each day. And that flows through to customer retention and whether people want to stay or not in our centers for Industrious. So I think we do it for a lot of reasons, but it's good business to make sure that people in your centers connect with each other and feel connected to the people around them.
Well, you know, it's funny. I work from my home. I have for years, for decades, on and off. But I do have a best friend at work. It's a black English Spaniard. and I thoroughly enjoy his company. And I only hope that I'm as good a person as he actually thinks that I am.
I'm jealous.
So I get that. But it is funny when you say community. I know for years, quite a number of years, I commuted back and forth on a very regular basis to London, where we had offices and still do. And I developed a sense of community within the travelers community when the flight crews on the long hauls from LA, where I used to live, to London, all recognized me and called me by name when I came on board. I felt I was comfortable. I was home. I was safe. And I would not change that airline because of that. I would do whatever it took to stay on those flights of that airline where I knew that crew would be there. And that's probably an extreme example, but it really is important that you feel at home.
I think that's a wonderful example. And I'm probably going to use that moving forward in other contexts. I think because people can close their eyes and picture it. They know what it means to be a long haul traveler where there are all the inconveniences and to do it often enough that people know your name and you feel welcomed. But I think that is different than what a lot of people picture when they talk about community. To my earlier point, I think people think it needs to mean, you know everything about everyone else and this is your crew of 10 people and you're inseparable. But there are lots of types of communities and they can be very meaningful. Even if they're around a shared interest and even if it's only once a month or every, you know, I don't know how often you were flying, but every 8 weeks or something like that. And they still are very powerful, meaningful to the individual and powerful sources of loyalty. So when people talk about community in a flex space and a co-working space, again, sometimes that can be hardcore and everyone knows everyone else's name and they're all going out to lunch every day. And sometimes it can still be a powerful community that on its surface seems a little more diffuse.
Well, let's kind of stay something related to that, but let's shift gears entirely here. And instead of talking about the people inside of a center or an office and the workers, let's talk about the other side of what's necessary in the workplace, and that's the landlords, the property companies. You are dealing with them on a regular basis. Those of us within the industry it's been both at times the love-hate relationships or incredibly powerful partnerships that can bring a lot of benefit to both parties. Your business model is a little different than some others, where it seems to me, and I'd like you to go into some depth here if you could, Jamie, that you seek to create a joint venture-esque relationship with the property companies as opposed to a classic landlord-tenant relationship, which the term landlord, I think that they were using that back in the days of the pharaohs. You know, I am the landlord. And I always imagine a castle with a moat around it, then, you know, peasant farmers, that sort of thing. But it's a bit of an anachronistic term. And in today's structure, I think it's not the property companies that held it back. I think the property companies would always be anxious to be creative. I think it's been the investment community behind them that has held them back from being more creative. And I don't know what your thoughts are.
Well, I'll start with the structure, as you said, and elaborate a bit on that, and then can touch on who, if someone is holding back the ability to deepen those partnerships, who would it be? So yes, so since the very first days of Industrious, the dream was to create a business where you would have joint ventures with landlords to turn a portion of their building into flex space, and then use that flex space to make the landlord more money on the 10% of the building that's flex space, but also to improve the performance of the other 90% of the building. That wasn't possible in the very early days of the business. You have to have a long track record and be able to persuade landlords that they should have to take the risk and put up the capital necessary to do that joint venture model versus simply signing a lease with you and clipping their check every month. So our first 30 locations or so were leased in the more traditional landlord tenant, asset owner, tenant model. Then we were far enough along that we could start going to landlords and saying, or going to asset owners and saying, there's something here and it's a powerful source of value in your building and it's going to help the rest of the building and we should be doing this shoulder to shoulder and it will unlock certain things if we do that. And we were eventually able to succeed in that transition in about 2017 or 2018. And now more than 90% of our network are partnership agreements, JVs with landlords instead of arm's length leases. And I will say it was a hard transition, but I think it succeeded my expectations in terms of what it is able to deliver. You can just deliver such a better product when you're sitting together with the landlord and saying, okay, are people going to use the same key card to access the elevators and access the space? And hey, the security guard was treating people poorly. We have to figure out what to do about that. It's very hard to deliver a great workplace experience on the fifth floor of a building if you have no say in what's happening in the entry sequence or on the way up or where in the shared spaces of the building. So I think it is where the industry is heading eventually, and I'm a true believer in it. And when you say, well, what's the obstacle to that? Who's been, you know, kind of stood in the way of that, of the creativity necessary to effectuate that business model? I would say you're right that I think it's the investment and lending community, because an asset owner are oftentimes entrepreneurial. What does this building need? What's going to make this building hum? What's going to make me money? And when you start to get to the investment side of things, the question is, okay, well, when you go to sell the building, what is some future buyer going to want? Think about homes. A lot of people want a quirky home. They want to make their home more interesting. They want to paint it purple. They want cactuses in their backyard instead of grass. But the thing that keeps them from doing that is they say, when you go to sell, you know, go for the thing that is the most generic. Go for the thing that would have the highest number of buyers. And that's not necessarily irrational. It's just one of the ways in which people, when they start to think about capital markets, not just what's going to make my building great, but what is some other buyer going to think they want, that can oftentimes drive conservatism, status quo bias, sticking with what's familiar.
Well, you know, I would agree with that. I know we were doing management contract participation leases, et cetera, back in the late 80s. So, and I know how hard that was back then. You can only imagine. But when you talk about working with the landlord, I was at a meeting in the very early 90s, sort of with a variety of property company luminaries. I had Trammell Crow in the room and Jerry Hines and Sam Zell. We were all in the room together. I was the punk. I was the punk in the corner, right? And I forget who asked Sam Zell at the time. He said, because Sam was building these smart suites, he called them, in his buildings, in the original Equity Office property buildings. And he built 58 of them. Hmm. They were basically executive suite or serviced office complexes that he built single floors. He had his own property people do it. And everybody was kind of like going, Sam, what are you doing? Why are you doing? You're wasting this good floor or that sort of thing. He came up with the best answer that I've ever heard anyone as a property company come up with themselves. He said, I want to service the entire life cycle of my customer. I want to service them when they begin, and I want to service them to the end. and that's the only way I can do it. And he built 58 of those facilities inside of his buildings. And that was in the late 80s, early 90s. So way ahead of his time. But today, he probably would be seeking, if he were still doing that, he probably would be seeking out you saying, Jamie, we want to do a JV. Because that works. That seems to work. I will comment, I made a pitch to Crow in the same meeting. And his answer was real simple. Young man, your tail ain't going to wag my dog.
That was the end of it. That sounds like a high-powered meeting.
So I didn't get that. I did not make that deal. But my tail was not going to wag his dog, and that was the end of it.
That's amazing.
So when we look at things like this overall, there's so many transitions going on in the real estate industry. And sort of the elephant in the room right now is artificial intelligence. And how do you see artificial intelligence impacting the capacity of the serviced office space group, your groups that you're part of, to provide additional layers of service and or to make improvements operationally that will create greater efficiencies that would serve the purposes of that joint venture with the landlord?
To me, there is a lot of opportunity in AI to improve what we do for a few reasons. I think most importantly, you know, we've talked a lot about in this conversation about some version of the concept of being seen, of individual service. And that really, part of the reason that's so important in our industry is that there's a traditional association with white collar work with being a bit invisible. You know, people will kind of talk about being sheep or, you know, an undifferentiated person in a suit that could be swapped in and out. And a lot of what makes great flex providers hum is the ability to make people feel seen as individuals. And that can be very hard to do. And it's hard to train on that. And it's hard to know enough about individuals to deliver on that. And so anything that can help sort of anticipate, process all the information necessary to say, this person tends to come in at this time, not this time. This person's a big coffee drinker, this person isn't. Hey, this person's anniversary is coming up next week, XYZ. It's a lot of information if you have 70,000 customers to keep a handle on, and it almost becomes impossible for any human being to manage all that information. So the application of AI to that, to anticipate customer needs, to segment customers, to enable your service people to seem superhuman, because they know what the person wants, because they know that their company just, you know, closed a big round or something like that. That's very powerful. And every time we've invested in that type of service, it's paid back 10 times over. And I think AI will be an accelerant to that. And also, you know, we've delivered 30 million days at work, we'll sometimes say. And if we're going to go to the JP Morgans of the world and the, you know, Googles of the world and all of the, you know, America's small businesses and say, we can deliver a better workplace experience for you than if you did it yourself, you really have to be an expert in what makes people love being at work. And there's millions of data points that are created in a workplace about the way people use the space, about their attitudes and interaction, about, you know, where, what customers are churning when, and it produces this sort of enormous but very messy world of data that I think we've done a moderately good job of mining for saying, how can we improve the product? How can we improve the product? But I think AI is going to be helpful in the next generation of insights that we're able to draw from that. Because what a shame to deliver people in, you know, 10, 15 countries, hundreds of centers, thousands and thousands and thousands of people, and not use that as a way to learn for what's working for them, what isn't, in the richest way possible, so you can keep improving their experience.
No, I would agree. I think it's this generation's tool, if you will, to use. And you mentioned data, and we have a little mantra in our own company, but and I think it's what you were strongly alluding to, is data has to become information, which is turned into knowledge, and knowledge allows for action.
I love that.
So it's that action of the data that it's important. The data itself is worthless if you can't turn it to knowledge and action.
Our analytics team often says data is like flour. Like, it's useful, but you got to know how to bake the flour into cookies. Like, that's what you really want, is the sort of the information, the action, something that you can actually do something with.
Well, you know, it's funny because one time somebody asked me, this is back in the early 90s, about the flexible workspace industry. He says, what do you like? What do you do? And I said, well, we're like bread. And I said, really? We take flour and salt and water and we make bread. And I said, but instead, we take people, place, and technology. We bond it together into a single product and we deliver it with a highly flexible service agreement. And that's what our industry is about. That's what you're involved in. That's what I'm involved in. And I think today, that's what the world is becoming involved in. The combination of those three things bonded together into a single structure. I think that's where we're going.
I couldn't agree.
So, Jamie, we're running a little long. I want to thank you for your time. You've been just marvelous to hear your thoughts. We're really appreciative of it. And we'll look forward to next time.
Thank you. Great questions. Great stories. This is one of my favorite podcasts I've ever done, actually. This was great.
My day is made. Take care.
If it's impacting the future of work, it's in the Future of Work podcast by Allwork.space. Are you ready?